According to the Washington Post, many American landlords have begun filing paperwork to evict struggling tenants already, and others have joined renters in appealing to Congress for significant unemployment benefits and another round of $1,200 direct payments to Americans. Separately from Moody's, the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia reported in October that 1.3 million households that have faced unemployment during the pandemic owed an average of $5,400 in back payments to landlords and utilities. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 29% of black renters and 17% of Latino renters are behind in payments, and 21% of families with children have been pushed into debt. Some families have been forced to begin selling their belongings since the Republican-led Senate allowed weekly unemployment benefits of $600 expire in July, according to the Post. U.S. lawmakers on Monday, December 7th, were negotiating a new aid package after a bipartisan group of senators introduced a $908 billion bill last week. According to Post reporter Jeff Stein, the package currently includes a $300 weekly payment, which would be offered only from January to April, with no retroactive payments to help families who owe rent and other payments from recent months. The package includes $25 billion for rental housing assistance, far less than what's expected to be owed by families in January, and only half of what the House Democrats' HEROES Act includes for low-income renters, and a proposal by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell did not include anything for struggling renters. This is like a Charles Dickens novel, Mark Wolf, executive director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, told the Post. It's an evolving story of how people at the bottom are suffering. Diane Yentl, president and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, called on U.S. Congress to extend the current eviction moratorium and provide rent relief to struggling households. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich highlighted the reports of struggling renters as the latest evidence that Georgia voters must elect two Democrats, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, in the runoff election scheduled for January 5th, to give the U.S. any hope of having a Senate which will help working families in the coming year.
Around the World with Reporters.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened, and now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable, and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation. But we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes you proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly. Like, the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines.
Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The EU is set to decide on sanctions against Turkey over Eastern Mediterranean tensions this week. European Union final decision will take place on Thursday on the grounds of recommendations from the EU foreign ministers meeting. The EU has been involved in Ankara-Athens tensions for a while now, since Turkey sent a search vessel to a disputed area. This comes as Turkish president is seeking to push for dialogue between conflicting parties and countries of the Mediterranean, including North and South Cyprus, assuring that Turkey is only after what belongs to it.
We are not after exploiting anyone's rights, but are only taking a firm stance against pirates that try to take our rights away. All actors will be able to find a win-win solution when everyone acts consciously with common sense and sincerity.
Turkey and Greece have been at loggerheads over the Eastern Mediterranean underwater energy resources dispute. Ankara enraged Athens by sending a research vessel to a disputed area in August, and since then, Greece has been calling EU to take actions against Turkey. However, many say it is not easy for the EU to take actions against Turkey for several reasons, including refugee deal and economic relations between Ankara and the bloc.
There is a division inside the EU when it comes to Turkey. There is an alliance led by France that is pushing for sanctions against Turkey due to latest tensions with Greece. There is another alliance on the other side led by Germany that is trying to reach consensus on a solution for the conflict. So the EU remains divided and imposing sanctions on Turkey.
Turkey says it had already shown goodwill when retrieving Uruç Reis vessel and agreeing on dialogue without preconditions. Many here believe the EU will not take serious actions against Turkey and is only after pushing Turkey to stop its activities in the region until a solution is found. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A number of ambassadors and military attachés of different countries in Taiwan have signed a memorial book to commemorate the high status of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the top Iranian scientist who was assassinated on November 27th. The diplomats have voiced their hatred and condemnation against this act of terror.
Right after the assassination, Russia has strongly condemned the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and believes that the main goal of such assassinations to destabilize the region and those who were behind his assassination should be severely punished.
As the ambassador of Iraq, we extend our condolences to the Iranian nation. Iraq has repeatedly seen many of such assassinations carried out by its enemies. Therefore, we fully understand the depth of the tragedy. We condemn Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination and call on the international community to get united against all forms of terrorism.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the town of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. He was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but succumbed to his wounds. The scientist had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote a once peaceful nuclear energy program.
We believe that if countries remain silent towards such acts of terror and assassination, terrorists will become emboldened to continue their acts of terrorism. Therefore, ambassador and military attaché of different countries have signed a memorial book both to pay tribute to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and condemn his assassination.
Experts believe the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
The ambassadors and military attachés of different countries who commemorated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh strongly condemned his assassination, saying the main perpetrators should be brought to justice anytime soon. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, where the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is still low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting any help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering.
Faisal al-Miqdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the US Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For Brexit supporters and many coastal communities, this deal symbolises regaining sovereignty in an age-old dispute over fishing rights. The UK says British fishing grounds are first and foremost for British boats, but the EU wants things to stay relatively the same with access for its boats and no tariffs or taxes on goods crossing borders. The EU's bargaining chip is special access to the EU single market, which the UK wants to hold on to as 60% of the fish its boats catch is sold to the bloc. The EU says something's got to give, though, insisting Britain cannot have priority access to its own fisheries and the EU market.
Mais comment expliquer aux pêcheurs?
How do we explain to fishermen that they can't go into British waters, but then they import fish to Bologna? That's very complicated, believe me.
Wars have almost been waged over these fishing waters. Britain and Iceland clashed over cod between the 1950s and 1970s, with the Royal Navy deploying 37 warships to protect British interests. The Scallop Wars in 2018 that saw French and British trawlmen come to blows in the English Channel threatened an uneasy truce reached in 2012, when the UK agreed to keep larger boats away from French waters in exchange for additional access rights. Since Britain formally left the EU on January 31st, negotiators have missed a series of deadlines to reach a deal with the world's largest trading bloc before the transition period ends on December 31st. And although the UK hopes these really are the last few days before a deal, it is not ruling out an extension.
I think we probably are now in the final few days in terms of being able to decide whether there can be an agreement. Of course, look, if the ambience warms up again and actually great progress is made and it's just about sorting out the detail, well, then you can always find more time, you can always extend. But I think unless we can resolve these quite fundamental divergences at the moment, then we are going to have to take a position in the next few days.
If a satisfactory deal is not reached, the British economy, which has already been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic, will suffer even more. And it will also mean bilateral trade falling back on World Trade Organization rules for 2021, which is far from Brexit's purported goal of taking back control. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The call on the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to resign followed the incessant killings, armed robberies, kidnappings, banditry, and the over a decade insurgency in Nigeria's northeast. Prominent elders, members of civil society organizations, religious leaders, politicians have advised the President to resign because he has failed to live up to the oath of his office to protect the lives and property of Nigerians.
He has failed on his own promises, the promises he freely made to Nigerians in 2015. People can no longer travel from Abuja to Kaduna, a journey of less than 200 kilometers. So what is the essence of being in government if you cannot protect lives and property, which is the basic responsibility of being in governance? This accounts for why Nigerians are asking Mr. President to resign from office.
But Nigeria's Minister of Information has fired back, saying no amount of hysterical calls for resignation will prevent the president from serving out his second term in office. Experts agree that President Muhammadu Buhari has not lived up to the expectations of Nigerians, but resignation is not the way to go. They said a citizens-driven security system is a new trend the world over, and Nigerians should get involved.
All the strata of leaderships in Nigeria, in general, and in northern Nigeria in particular, to live up to their responsibilities. When we say strata of leadership, it cuts across the military, the political class, the traditional rulers, the religious leaders. They should come, rise up and face the realities of these particular challenges that is facing northern Nigeria in particular and Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers.
Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit. Lockdowns and not more funding for health care is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program from the first and only federal stimulus plan spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Protests in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community, then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli or, for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The article you're about to hear under the heading U.S. Sanctions on China's CNOOC may backfire has been authored by Mark J. Valencia, who is a political commentator and consultant focused on Asia. Most recently, he was a visiting senior scholar at China's National Institute for South China Sea Studies and continues to be an adjunct senior scholar with the Institute. Valencia has published some 15 books and more than 100 peer-reviewed journal articles. Stay with us, please. The U.S. government has officially sanctioned China's third largest oil company and largest offshore petroleum producer, China National Offshore Oil Corporation, CNOOC. It is not clear why CNOOC was targeted, but the apparent reason for sanctioning CNOOC under this order is its involvement in exploration and drilling in disputed areas of the South China Sea. If this is the reason, the U.S. is using a rather loose and expansive definition of companies that are affiliated with China's military. CNOOC said that it was shocked and regretful that the action was based on false and inaccurate information, and that it is now comprehensively assessing the impact of the situation on the group. CNOOC Group focuses on the exploration, exploitation and development of oil and gas offshore China, along with its subsidiary COOEC or China Offshore Oil Engineering Company. The company is owned by the Chinese government. One subsidiary, CNOOC Limited, is listed on the Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto stock exchanges. Another, China Oil Field Services, is listed on the Hong Kong and New York stock exchanges. CNOOC's foreign operations account for about one-third of its total production. This includes projects in the Gulf of Mexico and Guyana, where it has a joint venture with ExxonMobil. But the executive order may not initially be too serious to a blow to CNOOC because it is so far limited to divestment, meaning that joint venture investments are apparently not prohibited and American holdings are relatively small, and there is uncertainty as to whether it will be continued by the incoming Joe Biden administration. Also, CNOOC may take certain measures to mitigate the risk, but there may be blowback. CNOOC owns some U.S. oil and gas fields and partners with companies such as ExxonMobil Corp. on some overseas projects. It also uses American technology and equipment. So the sanctions or the fear of their expansion will have some U.S. domestic effect. But there is much bigger potential problem of retaliation by China. ExxonMobil has also undertaken drilling in areas claimed by both Vietnam and China. What if China retaliates by sanctioning ExxonMobil for undertaking exploration and drilling in areas it claims, such as in Vietnam Blocks 118 and 119? China has threatened retaliation against ExxonMobil before for doing what the U.S. now alleges CNOOC is doing. In 2008, Beijing warned it against proceeding there, suggesting that its business in China could be at risk. Again in 2011, soon after ExxonMobil announced a discovery in Vietnam's Block 118, China warned foreign energy companies against exploring in disputed areas. In May 2014, CNOOC Limited moved a CNOOC group-owned drilling rig, Haiyang Xiu 981, into the area and drilled just east of Vietnam's Block 119. Vietnam claimed the rig was operating in its exclusive economic zone, while China maintained that it was operating in its waters. Until a ruling or a boundary is forthcoming, this area is disputed. That means ExxonMobil's drilling in these contracts would be legally questionable. But the U.S. seems to be implicitly taking Vietnam's side in its various relevant disputes with China, including this one. It should be noted that ExxonMobil is America's third largest company and is heavily invested in China. Its holdings range from gas marketing to petrochemicals. Indeed, it is now building a $10 billion petrochemical complex in China. If China does retaliate against ExxonMobil, it may prohibit any business dealings with it, similar to its ban on business transactions of any kind with American arms suppliers to Taiwan. Worse, it could stimulate a rethink in China regarding its economic interdependence with the U.S. This move by Donald Trump's administration during his lame duck period will make it more difficult for Joe Biden to revive relations with Beijing. But Biden could reverse this particular executive order before too much damage is done. Indeed, whether he does so or not may be a good litmus test of his administration's approach to China. Will it be an improvement or more of the same? Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kit Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We
need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target like one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
And we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. Everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns that we have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with a bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so, and everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
He's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous thing to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already, and the, you know, activists against fossil fuels and things like this, as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course, he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots, perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on as we show the clips in regard to that part of the programme. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but it does break it down in quite very obvious terms. He uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
we'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases. 51%. Yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforests for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's fresh water, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Truly some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kim Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received saying, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time, you know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on, but I mean, when he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. It, every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, yeah. Which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely. And if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction. It's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of the leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and the inhumane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing, and it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not they'll turn vegan is another matter, but they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on this, the people in positions of power, rather, than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, is they say, you know, use less coal, ride your bike, you know, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it and it's a political loser. In terms of, yeah, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I was invited to a meeting with Al Gore some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushed back. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, yes. Actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know. And that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you, talking to all these different organisations, you know. I understand lobbyists, I would expect that from them and to some extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the VT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another, go
what
on, sorry.
What was also interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money, have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes. Well, either they keep ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost, again, speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been, he would have lost the case.
He would have lost, yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time. Maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had run a farm.
Well, exactly.
A massive, massive farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing? Actually, they have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now.
The animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is putting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they are monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learn from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject, you know.
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's hard to say. The fact that their funding was removed and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists isn't a surprise as such. But, I don't know. Verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, if we hear that, according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, yeah. I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups, until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff.